Monday, September 3rd, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight we present the first of a series of lectures on the spheres of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life and their relation to Hermetic magic. Now the texts we will refer to are Paths of Wisdom by John Michael Greer, The Mystical Kabbalah by Dion Fortune, and A Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism by Gareth Knight, and Hermetic Yoga Beyond the Middle Pillar, Volume 1 by Frater Thabion. And Malkuth is the sphere where the Holy Guardian Angels are contacted. There are three of them. And where we find the treasure cave of the dragon. So, if you want to start at the bottom and then follow the dragon upward, tune in and we will begin the journey. Now, the dragon we refer to, of course, is depicted in Johann Gichtel's Elemental Man, that drawing that we derive the Western Psychic Center system from. And dragon rises up, and Gichtel even describes riding the dragon. Now, as we have said in earlier shows talking about Johann Gichtel, he was a bit of a prude. And as far as he was concerned, of course, the dragon was obviously the Western version of the Kundalini. He knew that, and he was a bit of a prude, but he still realized that we had to ride the dragon up to purify the spheres and purify the dragon while we were doing it. So he was kind of breaking the dragon like a bucking bronco and riding the dragon on up to the spheres, finally got it up to Tiphereth. And if you look at his drawing, and I'm sure all of you have seen a picture of it, of going up the psychic centers, the middle pillar, that you see the dragon kind of curled around Tiphereth up there. So the dragon lives, of course, down at the bottom of Malkuth, which is the lowest sphere in the Tree of Life. Now, quite frankly, it's been a while since we've gotten Kabbalistic on this show. Of course, Kabbalah is one of the root structures that that modern Hermeticism is based on. When I say modern, I mean ever since the Rosicrucian period. When Kabbalah was reintegrated back into the Hermetic system, and for a while it was separated from the Hermetic system, but the Rosicrucians reintegrated it back in, and then the Masons continued on with having it integrated into the system. So let's talk a little bit about the Tree of Life before we get into discussing Malkuth, which is the kingdom at the bottom, and that's where we are, by the way. That's the physical world, and it is probably the most important sphere in the Tree of Life. But we'll get into that once we describe the Tree of Life. So I think we need to go back and review a little bit on the Kabbalistic structure here. Now, in the Book of Solomon's Magic, which I assume by now most all of you have, on page 57, I have a very, very short one-paragraph definition of Kabbalah and the Tree of Life, and it reads this way. Kabbalah is a philosophical, mathematical, geometric system that describes the creation and operation of the universe through four dimensions by employing a schematic design containing 10 spheres of descending emanation connected by 22 paths attributed to letters of the alphabet and their numerical equivalents. Now that is a very, very quick, I'm not going to say quick and dirty, definition of Kabbalah. That's just the bare bones. And I went on to say, now this is a starting point, but not much better than giving weight, height, and color as the definition for an elephant. Essential to understanding Kabbalah is the concept of the Ein Sof, the limitless nothing that contracts into itself and produces the Ein Sof Aur, the limitless light, which then extends and produces the universe and continues to enliven or ensouls it. Now, this conception predates modern physics' Big Bang theory by thousands of years, and it also puts Kabbalah philosophy in a very controversial position in relation to Orthodox Jewish and Christian religion. At the highest level, the capitalist can conceive God is not judgmental or in any way dissatisfied with his creation. He simply is and continues to be. A contemporary popular analogy would be the Force, as in Lucas's Star Wars films. Now, that gives you a quick idea of the way the Kabbalah is works. It starts with this Big Bang, and then it descends through four dimensions, four different levels, and these levels can be thought of as levels of vibration. They can be thought of levels of size. In other words, the size and of size, frequency, and integers of particles. You can think of dimensions that way. And you can think of dimensions as geometric structures that are very tenuous, you know. And as we get into these various modern theories of physics, like string theory and M theory and all, we find we're going back more and more and more to analogs to Kabbalistic speculation. Now, as these four dimensions, they are all of them interlocked. In other words, they all exist, let's say, in one. If you had a box and you wanted to put the whole universe in a box, according to this theory, all of these dimensions would interlap with it, would interlap over each other. They would all be interpenetrating. However, in order to make this thing workable, we need to separate them for the purposes of working into diagram them, if you will. We need to separate them into four kind of egg-shaped structures and stack one on top of the other. Now, the way we're going to do this is we're going to create a schematic. Now, I think everybody knows the difference between a schematic and a map and a blueprint. They're all used in engineering. All of these three concepts are used in. And I know we're not all engineers, but even though Zandri and I would happen to be, but I mean we're not all engineers. But I think we all understand the difference between, or if we don't, let me quickly describe a map. Is a overhead projection looking down at where things are located on the ground below, so to speak, and into scale, like a road map. And a blueprint is a drawing, a plan, showing how something is constructed. How an airplane or cars or any object is constructed with its dimensions and in its perspective and its dimensions. Whereas a schematic is essentially a wiring diagram or a plumbing diagram that is not necessarily to scale. It isn't. A blueprint may show all the plumbing or all the wiring as it actually is and as you are actually going to install it, but it is in a way not as functional as a schematic, which does not have to be to scale and does not have to be it doesn't have to be something that you can go out and put it all together just the way it is laid out. A schematic shows the flow of, let's say, of electricity through the wiring or the connections that it makes, and it also, or in plumbing, it shows the flow of whatever it is you're running through the pipes, and it's an operative diagram of what goes where, but it doesn't go, it isn't to scale. Now, I think everybody understands that. So that's what the tree of life is. It's a schematic. And so we take these dimensions, which actually all coexist within each other, and we separate them into four circles or ellipses, and into those we place 10 spheres for one version of the tree. That's the so-called tree after the fall. And then, or 11 spheres for the tree before the fall, and in which, in after the fall, this 11th sphere in the middle becomes a hypothetical, and we put it in with dotted lines because it actually falls, down and becomes the bottom, becomes our Malkuth sphere at the bottom. So we have this diagram of these spheres. Now, this is something I want some of you, especially some of our students, to realize, that this schematic, in order to be really, really usable and in order to be really workable, should be done, should be created on a scale. Now, I know this is not a blueprint, but it still should be created on a scale, because the geometric relationships between the spheres and the paths and the way they're connected do have some importance in the structure in your mind, the way your mind works. Let's say that this tree of life is a sort of a computer program for your brain. It's a program. And it's a program which is not only a text program, because there's a lot of text that goes into this tree, but it's also a relationship program. It is dimensional relationships, spatial relationships, and geometric relationships. And therefore, it is a program in several languages. Not just the sacred alphabet, that's one of the languages, but it's also the relationships of the construction of the spheres. Now, the way this tree is constructed, it is constructed on a three-dimensional grid. Now, Leonora Leet, she did it inside the cube of space, which is another essential diagram, which we'll talk about. This cube, which is bifurcated. This cube is bifurcated. For instance, if you can imagine a cube, and imagine then lines running from the corners inside the cube to the other corner on the opposite side of the cube, and then back and forth. And you keep continually bifurcating this cube with these lines, and you end up with a matrix. You end up with a three-dimensional matrix, and you can construct a three-dimensional tree inside a tree of life inside this matrix. Now, my master Fred Adams came up with an even simpler and more usable method. He used Pythagoras's tetrachus. That's an equilateral triangle, and he bifurcated that and continued bifurcated in all these different crosshatch lines, and to where he produced a matrix that any tree of life that can be placed on this bifurcated tetrachus diagram is valid. You can have as many spheres as you want. And Isaac Luria must have used something like this, because Isaac Luria came up with a number of different. Isaac Luria is the great capitalist of the 16th century, and he came up with a number of different configurations for the tree of life. The one that we end up using is one that the Jesuit Athanasius Kircher came up with. That's the one that we end up using today, and that's the one you find in the Golden Dawn, and that's the one that most everybody uses for the 10-sphere tree after the fall. And any tree that you can place with the spheres and draw out on this Tetrakis diagram is going to be valid, at least in its construction. Now, your next question you're going to ask me is, well, where do I find this diagram so I can check this out? Well, we have it in Secrets of the Golden Dawn Cipher Manuscript, which is one of our books that we offer, and you can get it on Amazon. And it has that Fred Adams Tetrakis, and we trace out the Tree of Life, the Kircher design on that to show you how it works. So you might want to check that out. Now, the tree, as I said, it goes through these four dimensions. Now, the first dimension on the top, the beginning, is Otsaluf. And Otsaluf is where the Big Bang and the limitless light condense, and they become the sphere, the top sphere of the 10-sphere tree, or the 11-sphere tree, and we call it Kether. And it is the sphere of light. It is the sphere of it's the manifestation of the original manifestation of God, and in his creative sense. And so it produces the light, which then proceeds downward. Now, something I need to explain about Otsaluf is, remember I said that Otsaluf, all these four dimensions are coexisting with each other. And so we have and each one of them has a color scale. And we use the original Phoenician alphabet, an extended version of the original Phoenician alphabet. But then the Golden Dawn, of course, uses the Hebrew alphabet. And they have four. We have a color scale for the alphabet for these alphabets in each one of these dimensions. And the Otsaluf, being the highest power of God, that color scale for the alphabet becomes the color scale that we use to all the way down to empower our magical formulas, because that's the purest, highest power of God. And then the descending color scales become used for lesser powers. Now, what we're going to deal with now is the theory of emanations. Now, where the Kabbalists got this theory of emanations, they got it pretty much from Plotinus. And Plotinus, of course, was a follower. He was the creator of what was called Neoplatonism, because he was originally a follower of Plato. But what he did, when Plato had the idea that forms, thought forms, of course, go into this, are the thought forms of God create the universe. And then the thought forms of man, who is ensouled by God, the thought forms of man then in turn create what man can imagine is in the process of creation. And these thought forms become descending emanations. And the original creation of the spheres comes down from Kether, and then it goes down, it crosses into the next dimension, which is Bria. And Bria contains Hesed and Binah. It contains two spheres. This is the first duality. And this is where duality starts. This is like the Eastern, the Chinese yin-yang. That's the Western version of the yin-yang. This is where you have the power. One of them, you can say that Chokmah is male, and you can say Binah is female. So we say Chokmah is the creative force of God in this Briatic dimension, And Bina is the realm of the fixed stars. This is female, because the darkness of the universe, which is then filled with the stars from the marriage, let's say, of Chokmah and Bina. And this then creates, so Bina being the supernal mother, and in Phoenician terms, we call her Asherat of the sea, the sea being also space. So the Briatic dimension is the great yin yang, and this is where we get the first duality. Now, then below Bria, we have a large elliptical that we do it. Of course, as I say, all these dimensions are interlocked, but we have this large elliptical dimension called Yetzirah, and this is the formative world. And this is where we have the lower spheres below the duality of Chokmah and Bina. And we have Hesed, and then we have Geburah, and in the middle we have Tippereth, and then we have, you can see, as you visualize this, you can have a pillar down the middle, and the pillar goes from Kether on through Da'ath, which is that hypothetical one I'll talk about in a minute, and then it goes down through Kether right in the middle. That's the solar sphere. That's the sphere of beauty. And then it proceeds on down to Yesod, the sphere of the moon, and then down to Malkuth, which we're going to talk about tonight. And that's the middle pillar. And then we have these two pillars on either side. The pillar of mercy on the right side, and the pillar of severity on the left side. Now, the descending emanations in this tree are described as a flaming sword or a lightning flash. Now, the lightning flash is more accurate, because if it comes down, and those of you who have a tree of life in front of you right now, it'd be a good idea if you did. If you don't, I'm not gonna pause to let you. We'll pause for a commercial, maybe, and you can get up and get your tree of life and come back. But we'll skip that. But anyway, this lightning flash comes down. I think most of you have seen it. And it comes down from Kether, and it passes right on down. It goes into Chokmah, and over to Bria, and then down through Da'ath to Hesed, and then over to Geburah, and then down to Tippereth. And then down from Tippereth to Netzach, and then over to Hoh, and then down to Yesod, and then it goes from Yesod straight down to Malkuth, which is the sphere down there. Malkuth is the one sphere at the bottom in its own dimension, just like Kether is in its own dimension, and that's Ashia, and that is the dimension of the physical world. Here again, remember, all of these dimensions are interlocked. They all coexist within each other. And so Ashia is the dimension of the physical world, and that has one sphere in it, and that's Malkuth, and that's the sphere of the earth. Now, as you have probably gathered, these spheres, the tree of life, are also analogous to the planets. And those were referred to as the mundane chakras. In other words, the mundane spheres, the physical manifestations. So these, actually, if you want to get Kabbalistically technical, all of these, the planets themselves, all exist in Malkuth or in Ashia. They all exist in Ashia. And they are all directly connected by gravity and everything else to Malkuth. They're a part of the physical universe. And yet, at the same time, they have the higher dimension aspect that we in Kabbalah and magic attribute to them. And they have their own set of spiritual beings, which we contact, and as you probably have already gathered, astrology has a lot to do with this. And quite frankly, if anybody tells you that Kabbalah is not rooted in astrology, they don't know what they're talking about. Now, my answer to that is, if you don't think Kabbalah is rooted in astrology, just go ahead and get yourself a set of the Zohar. The Kabbalah Center Zohars are very good. If they don't ever do anything else, that was wonderful. Just get yourself a set of the Zohar and go through it. And if it doesn't make a capitalist out of you, it sure will make an astrologer out of it. I'll tell you that, because Kabbalah and astrology are very, very much interwoven. So, and magic, of course, Hermetic magic, the basis of Hermetic magic is astrology. And as you realize, as you develop magical correspondences and magical operations, you know, they're all keyed with astrology. Everything we do is related to astrology. And so sometimes when I'm talking about Gabura, I'll slip right back and talk about Mars, because they're interchangeable as far as I'm concerned. And the same thing about Tiberet and the sun. Now, this reason why I've been doing this is kind of review you a little bit before we get into this about the discussion of Malkuth specifically, to kind of review you on the basic principles of Kabbalah and how it comes down. Now, Malkuth is, as I said earlier, probably the most important sphere in the whole Kabbalah, because this is where we do it. Yeah, this is where we do it. This is the plane of demonstration. This is where it gets done. And this is where it gets manifested. This is where all the preforms end up. And I know my colleague Lon Duquette has a nice analogy where he goes back to Plato with Plato's example of the chair. There's a preform before a chair exists. There is a chair in the imagination. It's a preform, and there's a chair is visualized somewhere before it is built, and then it comes about. And the way Lon describes this, and I think it's very, very good. He says that the senior staff up in Bria. They get in touch with God up in Kether, and God says, rest. And the chairman of senior staff over there in Hokmah says, I think God wants a chair. And so they get a hold of the engineering department down in Yazira. And down in Hesed, and the chief engineer down in Hesed say, hey, God wants a chair. And the engineering department, the CEO of engineering, he says, we'll get right on it. And then he goes over to Gabura, and he says, put the boys on the drawing board. God wants a chair. And so they design a chair. And then in Tipareth, they start working on it. And then down in Netzach, they really get at it. Down in Netzach, they start, getting the timber together and whatever. And then over in Hod, they got the workshop, and they got the lathes, and they got the upholstery stuff, and they put it together. And then they send it down to Yesod. And you saw, and that's quality control. They check it out, and they think, yeah, this is pretty good. And then they put it down at Malkuth, and it's on the showroom floor. Now, I think that Lon does very, very well with that analogy, because this is the way it works. But now, the formulas, and because God wants a chair, that sentence right there, God wants a chair. We would do that, write that out in Phoenician letters and in the colors of the Atzilus color scheme. And that becomes the formula. And that is passed all the way down, and that goes down the line, that formula, God wants a chair. you know. And everybody's, oh boy, you know, and it keeps going. And that formula, as it goes down, it changes color. It changes the formula changes the color into the color of the dimension, the color scale, the dimension it's in. And finally, you know, when the chair reaches the showroom floor, it's got a price tag on it, which is God wants a chair, and that's what they call it. And when it's down there on the showroom floor, it's finally in the princess scale. And so this is a pretty good definition. Basically, this is a good definition of the magical creative process, which follows the actual celestial creative process, if you will. Now, with that in mind, let's talk about the characteristics of Malkuth. Now, I said we had some texts for reference. Now, let me talk about these texts. First, I said we had the Paths of Wisdom by John Michael Greer. This is very good, and we've used this one before in our series on the paths. And his write-up on Malkuth is fairly short. He hits most of the bases, and he had most of the correspondences. And I like it, and I think for a first reference on this is really good. The Mystical Kabbalah by Dion Fortune. Now, one of the things about the Mystical Kabbalah, I know a lot of people have this book, and Rigardi thought very highly of it, but there's a problem with it. At the time when she wrote this book, she was a Golden Dawn initiate, and she did not want to do anything on the paths because they were secret. The Golden Dawn, and that was one of the problems with the Golden Dawn, in my opinion, was that they put so much emphasis on the paths that they really did neglect the spheres. Well, Dion Fortune, so when she did her Mystical Kabbalah, she concentrated on the spheres and left the paths pretty much alone because most of that stuff she still considered a paratone, which is the Greek word for secret. So it's worth reading. The Unfortunate Mystical Kabbalah on Malkuth is worth reading. For one thing, she has a lot of practical advice, and because Malkuth is where you do your magical operations. That's where we have our magical temples, where we do our operations, where we make our tools, where we do where we do manifestations, where we do scrying, and all this kind of business and divination. And by the way, Malkuth is the sphere of divination. This is where you do geomancy, tarot, astrology. All of this is done in Malkuth. Now, so Dion Fortune has a lot of practical advice. Some of it is kind of Victorian. She's one of these Victorian occultists who like to talk about ectoplasm. Oh boy. And that, whenever I run into that, I kind of think, here comes the floating trumpet, you know, the play Twilight Zone music. I remember when we did the Houdini seance at the Magic Castle. We had an earthquake right in the middle of the seance, and boy, that sure added to it. And that, however, was not a special effect. It was an actual earthquake. So you can take some of what Dion Fortune's practical advice with a grain of salt. Now, A Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism by Gareth Knight. This is, especially on Malkuth, this is excellent. And one of the reasons why it is so excellent is because in the end of his article on Malkuth, after he gets through with the theory, he describes the elemental kingdoms and queendoms. Well, he doesn't call them, but he's still calling Peralta the king of the sylphs, and that's not good. She's the queen of the sylphs. And Nyxa is the queen of the undies. And by the way, that's something that we've done. We have made the male and female, the archangels of the quarters, and Basil Gareth Knight's Monday name is Basil Wilby, and he has a website. He's still going, by the way. He has a website. You can get on there. But his Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism has been reprinted. It's available. It's very, very good. It's a little dated too, but then he has some Britannia Rules the Waves kind of philosophy. So does Dionne Fortune, by the way. She's one of the things about Dionne Fortune's comments. Yeah, she's going on about talking about Eastern mysticism and talking about the mortality rate in the East and the squalor and the lack of sanitation and as if you just know that this is the British saving the Indians from their pollution and everything, but. Now, at this point, here all of this, and apparently all of this sanitation and good midwifing procedures and everything that we brought them during the colonial period, all of that sort of thing, we're negating it by all of our genetically engineered food that we're giving them. So I don't know whether some of this Victorian extolling is really valid in that respect, but make up your own mind. However, then the other book I'm referring to is Beyond the Middle Pillar, Hermetic Yoga Beyond the Middle Pillar, Volume 1 by myself, Frater Thabeon, and that one, I do want to naturally read you a little bit of what we have on Malkuth and the dragon in there. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of Malkuth as far as its correspondences are concerned. Now I'm going to go ahead and all of these books that I referred to give you a list of correspondences for Malkuth. They all do. Now, this is John Michael Greer's Malkuth, the Tenth Sphere. The title, Malkuth, the Kingdom. Name of God is Adonai, the Lord. The archangels are Metatron, Prince of Countenances, and Sandalphon, his twin brother, actually twin sister, because Sandalphon should be female. And Greer even admits that. The angelic host, the Ashim, that's humanity, and the astrological correspondence, Olam Shadoth, the sphere of the elements. Tarot correspondences, the four tens, the four pages or princesses of the pack. Elemental correspondence, the earth. Path text, and this is the Kabbalistic text. The tenth path is the resplendent intelligence because it is exalted above every head, and sits on the throne of Binah. It illuminates the splendors of all the lights and causes an influence to descend from the Prince of Countenances. Now let's stop and talk about that a little bit, because he's saying that it sits on the throne of Binah. Now remember, Binah was attributed to Saturn in the tree. After the fall, it is attributed to Saturn, but it's supposedly the realm of the fixed stars. This is not never this was never correct. So, however, in the tree before the fall, Saturn is in Da'ath, because Da'ath falls to Malkuth, and so and before the fall, the tree before the fall should have that has Da'ath as a manifested sphere is Saturn, and Binah is the realm of the fixed stars. But regardless, Binah is the Supernal Mother, and the Supernal Mother is also related to, and that's why this where this comes from, related to the Earth Mother, that's gay or gay and related to, and related to Sandalphon. But the point that I want to make here is that the physical universe begins, according to the Kabbalah, right in the center of the cube of space. It begins with Saturn. It begins with Saturn, and therefore Saturn has a relationship to the Earth. And Saturn relates to the Earth. In fact, it's so much so that one of the weaknesses of the Kabbalistic structure is they have no Hebrew letter for the Earth element, and so they use Saturn as whenever you want to invoke Malkuth, you have to use Saturn. You have to use Saturn as that point. And we use a septagram to do that, so naturally we have to use the Saturn point, and then when we declare the invocation, then we put the Earth symbol and say Adonai Haaretz when we do, because one of the weaknesses of the original Kabbalah was that they did not have a letter for the Earth element. We have since in our 11 sphere tree and tree before the fall, restored tree, we have corrected that. We've added two more letters to the ancient alphabet, and one omega and crater in the beginning, which fills that out. Now, to continue on this set of correspondence, the magical image, a young woman in a robe of mixed earth colors, her feet bare, her hair unbound, sitting on a throne of roughly shaped black stone. Now, this would apply both to the Archangel Uriel, and it also applies to the Angel Sandalphon. Additional symbols, the altar, the equal-armed cross, the temple, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now, this is important, and I want to digress a little bit here. In the Golden Dawn, and those of you who are familiar with it, there are two diagrams, the tree before the fall and the tree after the fall. In the tree before the fall, this represents the Garden of Eden before the fall, and then the tree after the fall is the Garden of Eden after the fall. Da'ath is the tree, is the sphere of knowledge, and Da'ath is the tree of knowledge, and is the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden, the tree from which Eve ate the apple, the tree which the serpent beguiled Eve. She ate the apple, and according to the way the Golden Dawn works out, Eve ends up down there with her falling down all the way down to where she's halfway into the cliff off at the bottom of the tree. And the cliff off, by the way, is something that we don't use in the OTA. The cliff off is a sump at the bottom of Malkuth, which the fallen shells of the unsuccessful entities created in creation fall down into this literally a sump at the bottom of the cliff. It's a cesspool, and it's filled with all of the pagan gods that the rabbis didn't like. They called them shells because, well, they after Ezra came back from captivity, they went on a Jewish evangelistic campaign all through Palestine, converting everybody and getting rid of their gods, and this is where they threw them down into the cliff off. So we don't go along with this. Well, our concept, as far as we're concerned, is that if there's a negative part of the tree of life, it's around the backside of the sphere. We're more monist than dualist. This whole cliff-off thing is a very dualistic, very, very dualistic thing. But then Ezra was very much influenced by King, by Cyrus of Persia, and Cyrus of Persia, of course, was a Zoroastrian, and so and they're very dualistic, and so he ends up equating all of the Hebrew Astarte, Baal, and even, and unfortunately, even Father El, the original god, got equated with Ahriman and all the Persian demons, and so they threw them all down in the sump. So if you down the bottom, but interestingly enough, if you notice the way the Tree of Life is constructed, the serpent of wisdom comes all the way up from the bottom, touching every path on the way up, going back up the tree, all the way to the top. And what is that serpent? That serpent? That's the same serpent that whispered in Eve's ear. And what did Jesus say? Be wise as serpents. Yeah. And so the snake ain't that bad. And Da'ath is like the apple, sphere of knowledge. Before you get start to thinking that I'm talking like a Satanist, I want to point something out to you. The Bible. One set of books, God was El. And the other set of books, God was YHVH, or Jehovah. Now, what Ezra did was he took all of the books that were where they called God El, or Elohim, which is plural, as you know. And that means that it was El was the Father God of the gods. He took all of those, and whatever he liked out of those books, he retained. And he put YHVH ahead of Elohim. So it reads Jehovah Elohim. In other words, Jehovah of the gods. And then he threw the rest of the book away. And so, and this goes all through the Old Testament, and it even continues into the New Testament. Hebrews was not written by Paul. And that Hebrews is where it says Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And Melchizedek was a priest of El. He was an Elohist. Now, these two books, so this has nothing to do when I'm talking about the serpent, and I'm talking about what happened in the Garden of Eden. It has nothing to do with Satanism. It has to do with the fact that the Bible was majorly plagiarized, altered, and perniciously edited by Ezra. I want to just explain that because there's so much symbolism in this. And in the Tree of Life, with the lightning flash coming down, the serpent coming back up, that you need to understand that we're not just because we don't particularly like Jehovah doesn't mean that we're not devoted to God. We are, now. The colors in Atzilut, the color of Malkuth is clear yellow because, as I say, all of these spheres of the tree exist in each of these dimensions in different levels. So in Atzilut, the color is clearly yellow. In Bria, it is citron, olive, russet, and black. Now, the Golden Dawn's Menuhin Mundum is their version of the Tree of Life. The paths are all in the absolute scale because the paths are active and the spheres are passive, and so the spheres are in the Briatic scale. And in the Briatic scale, citron, olive, russet, and black, that's the Those are the colors that you see on the Minutum under the diagrams of the Tree of Life. Now, in the Azura, it's the same, except they're flecked with gold. And in the Shia, which is the so-called actual color, if you can see it, would be black, red, with yellow. Now, we need to point out here about these colors is that these colors are all, these are magical color. These are not the colors that you are going to see when you scry. They're not scrying colors. They're not colors you're going to see on the astral, unless you have conditioned yourself so much where, yeah, you can. If you study them long enough, yes, you will see them in these colors. But these are colors we impose magically to get our magic to work. And that's something that a lot of people don't understand. That they think that these colors are, oh, this is what all these things actually look like. No. They're colors to be applied. They're colors to be applied because when we visualize with magic, we use the color, when we color the alphabet, the letters in the alphabet, when we use magical color in our talismans, in our talismanic images, all of these colors are what we use to activate the various dimensions. Now, I'm going to read to you what we have on Malkuth in our Hermetic Yoga book. And by the way, the mandalas for Malkuth, what we did, we have the citron, olive, resin, and black, just like Golden Dawn does. We use Golden Dawn colors as much as possible because they put a lot of work into it, and they're the best synthesis for correspondences since Trithemius and Agrippa. And they put a tremendous amount of work into these color schemes and whatever. So they have become hermetic standard pretty much all over the world. Now, what we did, though, that for this mandala, which makes it much easier to visualize, by the way, we took two pentagrams. One pentagram is black. One pentagram outlined with red on the olive drab on an olive drab background, and it's black and it's outlined with red and it's pointed downward, upside down pentagram. And then there's one on top of that superimposed. In yellow and outlined in white, and that's superimposed over it, which gives you a 10-pointed, star, which is what you need for this mandala. And then we put omega, a green omega, in the center of it. And omega is the letter that we use for the final, for the earth letter. And so, so the tenth sphere, the letter is omega. Om, the archangel send Alphon. The god form, of course, is Lotan the dragon, and the musical note is a low C. Now, we're going to talk about, I'm going to read you what we have on Malkuth in the book here. Malkuth, the kingdom. Malkuth is the one sphere in the lowest dimension of Shia, the realm of physical manifestation. This is where everything comes about. It's called the kingdom because it is the manifestation of creation and was originally thought to be paradise. To some Kabbalistic philosophers, it is the most important sphere of all because it is here that one plays the game of life and either wins or loses. It is filled with treasures and pleasures, and it has its own spiritual world that can include our ancestors and a host of elementals that can either aid or lead us astray. The fallen angels, which are an analog for many of us, were anxious to come down and enjoy the pleasures and challenges of life in the flesh. Thus, they devolved in a spiritual sense, finally becoming trapped in the mountain of darkness by their own physical and spiritual dissolution. But Malkuth is the realm of sacred nature, and some of the most inspiring aspects of God's creation are to be enjoyed here. Malkuth is also the sphere where you will encounter your holy guardian angels, because each sphere, the tree of life, contains all the spheres of the tree within its compass. Malkuth should be a place of love and beauty for all humankind, and we should strive to bring peace, love, and compassion to all our fellow humans. Through me flows a river of unlimited love is our transformation mantra, meaning that love should flow from us to all humankind and to nature herself. For the earth is indeed a goddess in her own right, the Anima Mundi of the Renaissance magicians, ruled over by the Archangel Sandalphon. The dragon in the caverns below, traditionally sleeping on his mound of treasure, represents our smoldering passions that drive us toward success, procreation, and creative endeavors. We can use this dragon as a steed to ride upward through the spheres of our body of light, carrying us on a spiritual quest to acquire knowledge, wisdom, and finally enlightenment. In this way, we evolve toward the light which created the holy spark within us at the dawn of time and stayed with us from lifetime to lifetime, always yearning to rise toward the fountain source of its holy brilliance. It is that spark that proclaims the great mystery, the great I am, and so are you. Okay, now, let's talk about the dragon a little bit. The dragon, as I said, is the Western version of the Kundalini serpent. Now, in the Kundalini serpent, as you probably know, is female, whereas our dragon is male. And our dragon, our dragon is male on the Phoenician side of the fence, but over on the Babylonian side, the dragon of chaos was female. And that was Tiamat. And as you remember, Marduk hacked her all up, Baal, with Tenet's help, of course, manages to master Lotan, as we do in our winter solstice ceremony. But we don't kill Lotan. We don't kill him. We control him. And in our Phoenician mythology. Now, if you're looking, those of you who have the book, and those of you who don't, there's only one way you can get it this year. Next year you may be able to get it, because we'll go public with it, with both volumes next year. But right now you have to be a member to get this book. So I encourage those of you who haven't signed up yet to get your letters in and get your application and get with us here. Now, the dragon in the Malkuth icon is lying on his treasure, sleeping on his treasure, and then we show him rising up to this hole in the ceiling of the cave, with light streaming down, and the spirit body riding up behind his head, and he mounted the dragon on the spirit body, and then ride him up to the spheres and visit the spheres. The way we do this is we use a version of Taoist yoga in this particular case, and we do a pump up with a fire breath, and then we pinch and start the dragon up the spine. It's a very powerful process, and those of you who haven't raised your Kundalini yet, this is a good way to do it. And as I said, you can look at Gitchell's Gichtel. I keep mispronouncing it Gitchell. It's Gichtel. And my German is not that good. But anyway, you can look at Gichtel's drawing, and you can see the dragon circling around Tiphereth. And Gichtel thought the dragon was evil. Well, the dragon is chaos, but rather than destroy chaos the way the Babylonians did, we would prefer to master the forces. And that's much more in keeping with magic, with the magical principle. And so, and by the way, let me point this out. Because it's a good analogy to chaos magic. In chaos magic, the dragon masters you. You don't master the dragon. And so this is the dragon of chaos is a force to be controlled and to be used, and that's the way we prefer to do it. Now, Basil Wilby here at night has a very, very good in the tail end of his chapter on Malkuth. What he does is he reviews the entities. And I'm going to read a little bit directly from him, because he's reviewing the entities that relate to the sphere of Malkuth, and I think that this is really excellent. Now let's see. That's on page 198. The practical implication of all this is. The etheric physical structure of the earth, which is built out of the projections of consciousness of elemental entities, it relies on humanity to put in touch with spiritual realities, as the elementals are creations of the created. That is, they are units of consciousness created by the evolutions of flame, form, and mind. And he's quoting now from the Cosmic Doctrine by Dion Fortune. And not by their own development, from the spiritual reality of the great unmanifest, they are doomed to extinction at the end of the day of manifestation, unless they have picked up spiritual vibration by that time. And the only way they can do that is through the meditation of humanity. This is a reverse of the old idea that if you don't believe in fairies, they're going to die out. And as the majority of humanity seems blissfully ignorant of its own spirituality, let alone the existence of the elemental kingdoms, it will be obvious that the plight of these elemental entities is a grave one. See, Basil is very, very much a British folklorist, along with being quite a good magician. That's what he's referring to, is this old idea. Like the fairy, you know, we've all heard the story, and one way or another, when a little kid goes out in the woods and finds the fairy, and the fairy's crying, and the little kid says, "Why are you crying, little fairy?" And the fairy says, "Nobody believes in us anymore. Nobody believes in us." And, well, I did. The kid says, "Well, I believe in you." "Ooh, yeah, you do, but you're the only one, you know." And this is what Basil's talking about. And this is true. If you believe in elementals, they exist, and they do. I don't know what Bill Mesteel thinks about this, but probably he'd go along with the same idea. I imagine he would. He believes in some beautiful mermaids over there in Hawaii, and he's found a few. And the sum total of all of these elemental entities which hold together the esoteric stresses of the planet is called the planetary being. In some cosmologies, it is referred to as the planetary spirit. But in the light of the facts just stated, the title is a misleading one, for it has no inherent contact with spirit. The Archangel Sandalphon is its guide, for she holds the concept of what it should become. And this concept, which has objective existence on its own level, can be called the planetary entity. However, the bridge between planetary being and planetary entity has to be built up by humanity itself. And this constitutes one of the tasks of the initiated adepts, though it is really the responsibility of all humanity. The planetary being is helped much by the right attitude to earthly things, that is, the application of spiritual principles in ordinary life. The ethic of Malkuth, order and efficiency, has to be consciously pursued all day long. And it is a little used for short periods, only as a ritual working or regarding this task grudgingly as a duty or for convention. Also, the planetary being cannot be helped much by the intellect. Let me digress a little bit here. This is earlier on in this article on Basil talks about living in the moment, which of course is quite a big has been a big thing, and you know, as people, oh yeah, I'm in the moment, I'm living it, and living that. And he says that this is very important. Hardly any of us are really living in the moment in the physical world. We're not relating to it. We're thinking about something else, and we're remembering things, or we're thinking ahead, or whatever, and we're not aware of all of the beauty and all of the natural the natural things occurring around us. And I get to thinking when Fred Adams and I both knew Basil and corresponded with him, and Fred met him. And over there in England, but I never met Basil, but Fred was very, very much into this business of becoming one with nature. Going out and don't close your eyes, and when you do yoga in a natural setting, open your eyes and do yoga with all the nature, with all the setting around you. And become one with it, you know. Be part of the nature you're in, and be part of the world that you're in. And Basil makes a nice, very nice point about that. But later, of course, he had Basil took up with a Christian, with a fundamental Christian minister, and they went out and they exercised pagan ley lines, and thought, oh boy, woof. Oh man, that wasn't too good. But let's see. In all these considerations, the distinction must be borne in mind between Earth as a planet, Earth as one of the four elements, and Earth as Malkuth, the physical plane of the whole universe. Thus, the traditional archangel of Malkuth is Metatron, the same being who is the archangel of Kether, which again shows a strong link between spirit as spirit and spirit as matter. Sandalphon is really the archangel of planet Earth, and the archangel of the element of Earth is Oriel. Oriel or Uriel is one of the great archangels of the four quarters. In the east, of course, is Raphael, in the south, Michael, in the west, Gabriel, and in the north, Uriel. The first of these three angels have already been described. Oriel is a great figure built up with the dark green and browns of Earth, and who inner aspects represents the primeval light of God himself, and who is much concerned with the great teachers who have periodically come to Earth. Thus, in the east is the great source of healing. In the south, the great source of balance and protection. In the west, the great source of vision. And in the north, the great source of teaching. Those of you who are involved in our program realize that we spend quite a bit of emphasis on invoking and internalizing these four great archangels. And in fact, we just did, just this last Sunday, we did a Raphael, and before that we did an Oriel invocation. Thus, in the east, the great source of healing. In the south, the great source of balance and protection. In the west, the great source of vision. In the north, the great source of teaching. Uriel is also connected to Michael as a great balancing force that is behind the great cataclysms of Earth, such as are described in the legends of Atlantis, Sodom, and Gomorrah. In building up the forms of the archangels of the four quarters, they are best conceived as great fortresses or towers, colored in the active colors of the element, and concern as yellow, red, blue, green, respectively, as opposed to the passive colors, blue, dark red, silver. Peter penetrating all can be conceived, the archangel Sandalphon in citron, holly, russet, and black, pulsing with the slow vibrations of earth. Now we're running a little bit over time, and so I'm gonna wrap this up. He goes on with the kings of the elemental forces and the queens. Well, he doesn't differentiate. He makes them all kings, and Perelda should be a queen, I think, and Dejin, the salamanders, is a king, and what have you. However, even though Basil has not genderized these, that doesn't mean that this isn't an excellent book, and I really recommend it. If you can find it, A Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism. And without this book, I don't think our pathworking system, even though we use Kirpal Singh's system as a model, I don't think we could have really capitalized it as well as we did if it wasn't for Basil's book. And if you're listening, Basil, hope we sell a few for you. Anyway, so this about wraps it up. Next week we're going to mount the dragon, and we're going to go on up the Asad and talk about the sphere of the lunar sphere, the sphere of the foundation, and the significance of that. And so until that time, good magic, and take care and be well.